Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we are joined by one of our best favorite, all-time favorite guests, Professor Emeritus, and he doesn't like when we go on about it, but this gentleman was our very first live show guest, Professor Emeritus PJ Drudy. Listeners will have heard, I think the last time we spoke was around Christmas, Martin, if I'm right in saying that.
Yeah.
And we always love to get PJ's input. PJ, thank you again for taking the time to talk to us.
Not at all, Tony and Martin. I'm absolutely always delighted to talk to both of you because I have great fun with you and have had great fun in the past. So I'm looking forward to it. You asked me about the Housing for All plan, and I had written this little piece in the Irish Times prior to it, of course, in the very naive hope that, oh, well, obviously they'd heed everything I say, really knowing that they probably would throw it in the bin immediately. But anyway, I mean, I suppose some of it has been realized. I pointed to various things. First of all, I suppose I said there had to be a major increase in social housing, and my ambition would be 10,000 homes per annum over the next 20 years, probably. But certainly not just for a short period. The second thing I wanted really was a cost rental. And that would be for people who are not eligible for social housing. And of course, there's large numbers of people in the private rented sector now who are not eligible for social housing, but who are paying extortionate rents to whether it's Irish landlords or international landlords. They're paying outrageous rents, 2,000, 2,500, 3,000. For a fairly small apartment, 2 to 3 bedroom at the most. So they were the two big issues, cost rental. And I think I'm disappointed in particular at the cost rental. The other third issue, I suppose, was that I did call for housing to be recognized as a right of everybody. And that's not a huge demand, funny enough. All one is asking there is that the government would move progressively towards the idea that every single person would have a home of some sort, whatever their income, whatever their position. I didn't realize that. So what did they do? Sorry, one other thing that I did say in the article was that we needed to counteract the whole issue of financialization and commodification of housing. And this is something that Rory, my former student, and of course one of your fantastic
stable mates,
indeed, staples, if you like, has gone on about for years. And his new book, by the way, if people haven't seen it or heard about it, it's very, very good. It's called Housing Shock. But really, there are the four issues. Now, financialization, we've just relied an awful lot. Perhaps I'll deal with this one first. We've relied an awful lot on commodification. If you have money, you get a house. If you haven't money, you don't get a house. And so what has happened is housing has become an asset, has become a wealth generator, has become an investment as opposed to a home. And I think that's really a fundamental problem. And it's a fundamental problem throughout the world, mind you. Leilani
Farah,
who was the former rapporteur on adequate housing in the UN, and sorry about getting her name wrong, but she has argued very, very strongly that financialization and commodification is a real problem for all of us. So it's a change of heart and a change of mind, really, is absolutely required. Now, a lot of our multinational people coming in here buying homes, are currently building them, are involved in this, and they're making a major contribution to this commodification issue, and they're charging extortionate rents, and they're just not good for the country, can I put it that way? So that's one issue that I mentioned in the article.
Hi folks, going to interrupt the podcast just to ask you a couple of things. One, please, if you can, support us at patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And two, are you aware of what you're missing out if you're not a member? In the last few days alone, we had Soc Dems TD Holly Cairns lifting the lid on what goes on in terms of private sessions, committee sessions, and how we should all be concerned that some of the things that we need to hear in our legislative process are done behind closed doors. We had Seamus Malkazali on to talk Afghanistan, 9/11, and basically the world turning away from what's happening in Lebanon at the moment. We also had, you probably heard, Patrick Costello lost his case against the Irish government for CETA, but we had Patrick himself outline some of the good findings from the judge as well as the negatives. It wasn't all bad news. And there's also the me and Martin reaction pods that are for patron only. They're just a flavour of some of the things you've missed out on just in the last few days. So if you like what we do and you would like to hear more of it, or you want to get access to these extra podcasts, it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It's the price of a fancy cup of coffee a month, and it really, really helps us keep going. We'll let you get back to the podcast now. Thank you. Yeah, no, I want to point out to listeners, yesterday, Canada, Justin Trudeau, 10 days out from the election, so you could say it was cynical or electioneering, but he pledged to end the foreign purchase of properties in Canada. Now, I know you mentioned Leilani Farah, who I actually spoke to yesterday because she's a friend of the pod and contributes, and she will contribute shortly. It's something that she's been advocating for a long time in Canada, but something that she wrote to the Irish government about, PJ, and was told that actually, you know, you're wrong, we're right, these guys make up a significant, these guys are important to our ability to deliver homes or houses or apartments as they more or less do. So how do you feel we reconcile that kind of the idea that IRS REIT with Canadian money is purchasing properties and in Dublin, but in Canada itself now, it's been told no more of these foreign purchases. It seems to be a huge conflict within the Irish financial system and the financialization of housing.
Well, I agree with Leilani and yourself really on that one, because really the Irish government made a huge mistake in inviting, in encouraging, in fact, multinational firms to come in and purchase, as it was at then, distressed properties. And they've come in their shoals, not in their thousands, but certainly there's large numbers of these firms have come in now. Whether it's Kennedy Wilson or whether it's Stargate or whatever, it's all sorts of firms have come in. And the forward purchasing thing is an absolute disgrace, because what is happening is they're purchasing perhaps 500 homes or apartments at a time. They could be houses, as they did in Maynooth, or they can be apartments. And when you forward purchase like that, and when a firm agrees to a firm building the homes agrees to a forward purchase, what you do is you eliminate competition. And so you destroy the supply. In fact, you confine the supply to one or two or three major players. So forward purchasing is an absolute disgrace, and it hasn't been stopped yet, and the Housing for All has not done nothing about it. So I think I mentioned that in the article also. Forward purchasing is simply wrong, and it's happening again and again and again and again. And it simply crowds out, if I can use those words, crowds out ordinary purchasers. And if that did not happen, then and 400 apartments comes on sale, well, it would keep the price down. It would automatically keep the price down.
And when you mentioned cost rental, when you look at the plan, and then you say, we mentioned the volume of cost rental. So I know, again, recently in your bailiwick in Dublin Bay South, there was a by-election, and they talked about, you know, the candidates for the government parties talked about, well, we've introduced cost rental. And when you drill down into it, it's 400 units. And 400 units isn't going to get it done, PJ.
No, it's buttons, absolutely. I think they mentioned a figure of 18,000 over a period of 10 years or something in this Housing for All. I haven't it in front of me.
They have. It's exactly 18,000 over the 10-year plan.
You want 10,000 a year at least, I'd say, for the next 10 years, because there's huge numbers of young people and not so young people in the private rented sector now, often on HAP or on RAS. They're the housing assistance payment or the residential accommodation scheme. Now, those are costing us up to $1 billion a year of state money, of your money, of taxpayers' money, and for which no single unit will be available at the end of that tenancy. And of course, the tenants are not secure. There's no security of tenure. I heard a young woman on yesterday on radio actually saying she was in a HAP property. That's the housing assistance payment property, paid for by the state, but she felt very insecure. She said, I can be thrown out at any time because we failed to deal with the legislation in relation to whether a landlord can get rid of you at a moment's notice or not. And again, Housing for All does nothing for that.
Peter, so, you mentioned that this is a global issue. How do we in Ireland book the trend? How do we book the global trend of having these vultures in?
Well, I mean, it amounts to political will, Martin, in my view, that you want a government that is quite strong, is courageous, and says, look, we're going to build these homes ourselves. And certainly we'll phase them out. We'll give them, perhaps we can't get rid of them, private property and all that. But I mean, certainly we can compete with them. So what I cost rental, if you build 10,000 social housing units a year, you will get rid of the HAP. You'll begin to get rid of the HAP anyway and the RAS. Mm. So automatically, people will leave the vulture funds and they'll go into these houses. And similarly with cost rental, it's the same thing. You're taking them out away from the vulture funds who are charging extortionate rents, and you're giving them rents at a reasonable price, obviously, for social housing. And as regards cost rental, we haven't said it, but basically cost rental is supposed to be self-financing. Mm. The government borrows a considerable sum of money, now at virtually no interest rate at all, and a mortgage taken out over 30 or 40 years, say, and the tenant pays only the cost of the building of the property and the management of it. And rents, estimates have been done of this, and rents can be as low as 600 or 700 euro a month, as opposed to 2,500 a month, between 600 and 700 and maybe up to 1,000 a month. So there's a massive saving by tenants, which would enable them, if they want, to save for a deposit, if they really want to purchase a home. But cost rental would be secure, it would be good quality, it would be cheap, it would enable people to stay there forever.
Yeah, it gives security of tenure.
Security of tenure is the key.
And I just want to, again, cost rental has the potential to be a real change maker. And the government know this because in their own report, in certain electoral districts, these big players, these IRS REITs, the Hibernias, these companies, they control what they call in terms of, and again, the reports are up there on their own report saying they control maybe say 40% of all beds. So that's units. That's where people sleep. And when you do that, you set the rent. And the only way to tackle that is to actually have an equivalent that is cost rental. Unfortunately, PJ, the cost rental that we're doing, and again, Dara O'Brien, talk to you soon, Dara, said to us, you know, cost rental with a slight profit.
You've got it in one, Tony. It's non-profit. It's not for the private sector shouldn't do it because the state should do it. There's no excuse for handing it over to the private sector. They've created mayhem enough. I started the article, by the way, in the Irish Times in saying, well, we have to get rid of this undue reliance on the private sector. There's nothing wrong with the private sector. They are profit-making. It's rational for them to want to make as much money as possible. But housing is so important. It's such a fundamental thing for every single person to have a roof over their heads. And I'm not talking about a five-bedroom house. I'm talking about whatever people need in terms of a roof, a safe place over their heads, where they can be part of a community, where they can talk to their friends next door or down the street and so on and so on. It has to be a home. So really, the private sector is not geared up to do that. The private sector is geared up to make money. And fine, let them go on making money. That's fine. But the state must compete with them in a serious way through provision of social housing and cost rental. And as you say, cost rental is a game changer, or could be a game changer. There's no excuse for not expanding it dramatically now. By the way, could I also say that the state could, why doesn't the state, they'll say, well, we haven't the workers. The workers aren't. Why doesn't the state set up its own building firm? A national building firm where they bring workers from far and wide outside the country and within the country, and they say, we are going to give you a guarantee of employment for the next 5 years or 10 years. if you join us. We will not pay you a fortune, but we will pay you a good wage, a decent living wage, and we will give you a proper pension scheme. We'll pay into a pension scheme for you. We'll give you good conditions, and you will work with us on housing for the next 10 years. Why doesn't the state do that?
Because it would mean actually, I don't know if you remember this, PJ, but in NAMA's founding document that said NAMA has the powers to better society, and I could be paraphrasing, but I'm pretty sure I'm on the money with that. That was never its ambition, though. So the likes of NAMA and the LDA were formed with the basis to be able to do these, but very quickly they became delivery units for the private market as opposed to what the statement goals were, you know, and that's where the issue lies. And I put it to you that this is still ideological to this day.
It is absolutely ideological. What kind of, you're asking the question there, both of you have asked me this before, what kind of society do we want? That's the key issue. And we want a society where there's fair play for everybody, young and old, fat and thin, disabled and well, and so on. Everybody. And unfortunately, the ideology is wrong. The ideology is of, well, really, if something is priced well, that's valuable. Now, that is a dreadful attitude, really. The very interesting book by a woman called Mariana Mazzucato, and she talks about value. What is value? And normally, in society, price is the thing that measures value. If something is expensive, oh, that's very valuable. But that should not be the case. There's lots of value out there. For example, the caring. People care for people all the time for nothing. That's hugely valuable work. People look after the environment. That's valuable work. There's a whole range of things that are not priced and shouldn't be priced. They're not priced. They cannot be priced. It's impossible.
When you talk about workers, I've done a huge amount of to and from workers in the construction industry, and I have no doubt that if they were offered steady, good employment conditions with pensions, now the wages don't have to be through the roof, but the steady would be a huge thing for a lot of guys in the construction industry, and it would professionalize their industry where it's so unprofessional at the moment. There is no list of bricklayers or list of plumbers or tradesmen in this country. I mean, it's ridiculous to think we have some of the best tradesmen in the world, yet we haven't professionalized what they do.
No, you're right. I think it's a very important route to travel, really. And I don't think many have talked about the idea of a state building agency. Why not? As you say, security, everybody likes a bit of security. They want to know, what am I going to be doing in the next 5 years? Because I'm trying to get a mortgage or I'm renting and I want to be able to pay the rent. And I want to have a little holiday now and then. So security is key. And training. The state will obviously should become and is becoming involved in training in a serious way. So apprenticeships for carpenters, for block layers, for plasterers, for painters. There's tremendous possibilities if the state said, we are going to do this. And that would be part of the competition. I'm tending in a funny sort of way.
That's actually a really important point. Sorry to cut in, but it's a really important point. Listeners need to understand this. That can drag standards up in the industry, not the other way. It can mean that the private developer then has to stop having the subcontractor of a subcontractor or a subcontractor, and we can start to see those standards get dragged up as opposed to, you know, this. And I just think
you could have a workforce, Tony, who are highly trained in doing zero emission building.
Yes.
And they've built up those skills by working together. Yeah,
retrofitting absolutely. The million homes that we need to retrofit and tackle the climate crisis.
It only makes sense. It only makes sense.
It's all very ad hoc at the moment.
Yeah.
If you want, you know, it's all very ad hoc. I don't know what to do in social housing, the various local authorities. They're all floundering trying to find somebody. Instead of having a cadre of workers from architects and engineers and so on down to laborers, and nobody in many ways need to be a laborer because there's so much fantastic machinery now. This morning we had a skip where I live, And there was this huge lorry lifted up this massive skip onto the lorry. I mean, the technology is there, so labor is not there anymore.
I don't know if you heard, we had Rory had Rob Cass on, who's down in Waterford and a big advocate for, you know, he's saying it's 165,000 euro is to produce, say, a two bedroom unit, not this 365. Everything else is builder or developer profit. Yes. And there's a factory in Leeds that's churning them out, these modular homes at 160. And he asked them, the county councils, have you gone to see the factory? And he went, no, but we've accepted wisdom that when Tom Parlour walks in from the Construction Industry Federation, that it costs 375,000 to do it. That's the accepted wisdom. And I put it to you that, and again, this is a dig at your own life, work, in economics. The economists have too much say on this. That there's too much accepted wisdom around what the economists have said.
Oh, there's no question about that. The economists have been a complete menace to society, if I could put it that way. But basically, I remember looking a few years back, Dublin City Council illustrated the a number of units up in East Wall, showing they had been, you know, put together in frames of various kinds, either in sort of concrete or steel or whatever. They were perfectly adequate homes, very well insulated and so on, and they were costing very, very little at the time. And of course, as you probably know, the O'Coolan Cooperative has been doing building in North Dublin, and they're doing it now down in Kilkenny. A wonderful man called Hugh Brennan runs it. And he can build a three-bed to four-bed semi for 250 grand to 300 grand maximum. Now, that's using the standard original idea of block laying and so on. You're talking about these compartments being put together. An entire wall, for example, is brought on a crane. I know a bit about it, funny enough, because I got an extension done to my house many years ago. And it was timber built. And the wall of the little extension came an entire wall. And the roof came in a whole section. So, I mean, they were assembled in the factory in advance. That is the route to travel if you want to do building fast. So the house was put up in a day. And there was some work to be done inside, obviously, but it's a rapid way of doing it. But you can ensure quality. But going back to the workers, it seems to me that the point made by Martin there about the security of workers would be very attractive. So a state building agency, I think we should travel that route. There's a few more things about Tony and Martin about that Housing for All plan. I had raised the issue of, I simply had one sentence, in fact, in that article, saying that we must be wary of increasing demand. Now, I know we're all talking about, and we've been talking about it up to now, about increasing the supply of housing via social housing or cost rent by the state. But the problem is that if money is pumped into a system where there isn't a supply, then what happens is the price goes up. So the government has instituted two schemes, the Help to Buy scheme, which seems very attractive on the face of it to young purchasers. To say the state has said, oh, well, we'll give you 20 grand back over a few years if you purchase one of these new houses. It's called a Help to Buy scheme. And it's a carbon copy of what George Osborne did years ago in the UK. And the impact in the UK was exactly the same as the impact here, was to increase house prices. So the 20 grand that you thought you were gaining is actually built into the price of the house. Because the builders say, oh, this is a gravy train. Let's increase the price of the house. And that's all that happens. So that's one issue. The other thing that has been proposed by Darragh O'Brien, and I think in fairness to Darragh O'Brien, I think he means well. But he has, I think, been ill-advised to bring in this equity scheme where the state takes part of the house purchase. And again, all that does is it pushes up the price. So the idea of demand is important. This is why the central bank has introduced rules and regulations which says, well, you can't borrow crazily. And I think they're dead right, because a lot of people during the last crash borrowed enormous amounts of money and were allowed to borrow enormous.
You're looking at one.
And then there, you know, and I mean, and the reason the interest rates were low and you were allowed to do it, and unless you were very lucky, you could run into trouble. And I hope to God, Tony, that you didn't. But that's the problem with a scheme that seems very attractive on the face of it. Now, I don't want to dwell on that one, but that's.
I think it's really important again to point that out, because we have got pressure, and it's come from the Taoiseach, where he said that he welcomes the central bank's commitment to reviewing the mortgage lending rules. And it's important also to point out that if we go back 6 months earlier than that, that the current central bank governor was considered a political appointment by the ECB because they weren't happy with Mr. McAlouf coming in from New Zealand, given some of the things. And Pascal Donoghue basically wrote to them, told them, mind their own business. So there is an element of, we have to be very careful that we don't get back into a credit bubble domestically while we're also hugely reliant on foreign capital. But I want to come back to the broader thing on economics and the economic orthodoxy. There's been so much said post-pandemic, post-recovery, and I've seen the statistics, PJ, and they're staggering. So, for example, Spain wants to build out of the COVID-19 pandemic with a green return, that they're investing huge amounts of money. I'm talking into the billions to retrofit public buildings and homes. Excuse me, that if you do it on a per capita basis, Ireland is about less than 10% of that, because Ireland, then we had, and again, John Fitzgerald, I think I'm right in saying, writing in the Irish Times recently, former member of the Climate Committee and former ESRI economist, saying to us that, well, the accepted wisdom is that Joe Public has to pay for all of this. I put it to you that the other countries are not taking that same mindset. They're investing in this capital now.
No, you're right, Tony. Just going back for 1 second to housing, the key issue, all these schemes can increase house prices. The key issue is to reduce house prices and rents. That, I think, has to be the aim of everybody. But to your question, the state really has to play a fundamental role in climate change. They cannot avoid it, and it's so, so important. And basically, if they don't, all that will happen, I mean, all right, I can do a bit of recycling and so on. I am doing it. I'm serious about it. But what I do is very, very tiny. While the state has a lot of control and they can introduce, whether it's carbon taxes or they can push and push and push towards renewable energy or so on, they haven't done so in any serious way. But what it means, if the state does it, is that they're saving in health issues, they're saving in flooding issues, they're saving, and it has to do it internationally, of course. It's not enough for us to do it. But, I mean, if we don't take action, the sea is rising at about 1 meter every, whatever it is, 30 years or 50 years. Certainly it's rising, and the whole place, the whole world is warming up. And what we will have is massive flooding, and houses that are now by the sea, enjoying the scenery and so on, will be flooded without question in 30 to 40 years' time. Not during my lifetime, but during yours. And that is surely to be debated. And so therefore, there's an enormous possibility for the state to do the right thing in relation to climate and to stop this nonsense of destroying the environment, whether it's through plastics or whether it's through polluting the sea, which we're doing on a regular basis. We've got to clean up the place and make life healthy for our citizens. So it comes back to not making money, but kind of investing now to have a better life for everybody. And it's now we can get lots of money at very, very little rates of interest. There's no excuse for not taking serious action.
You mentioned ideological. And would it not be the case that it is homeowners themselves that are preventing the political will to go and build social houses or the houses that we need, that it is the current crop of homeowners themselves who are voting for parties who won't change the dynamic? And that's where we are stuck at the moment.
You're absolutely right. I think people who own homes say, oh, I've invested a lot of money in this house. In fact, they have got probably a lot of them would have got mortgage interest relief on those homes, certainly if in past years. So, I mean, they're sitting pretty, as it were. So they tend to oppose social housing here, there, and everywhere. And I think that's a fundamental problem. In fact, in my own area where I live, I was probably one of the, I think I was one of the very few who favoured social housing in on a site that is actually owned by the county council. And it was opposed so strongly that it didn't go ahead. There would have been a small number of social housing units for older people or whatever at the time, but it was opposed. And I was bitterly unhappy with it, but I could do nothing about it. And it's the same around the country. So, I mean, there's a change of heart is required by all of us.
Would a constitutional change, to some degree, take that out?
It would. I suppose if you put in the right to housing in a constitution or in legislation even, then it would certainly stop people totally objecting to everything. Now, in fairness to people who object to things, they usually object for in relation to, for example, height or overdevelopment. That they're two big ones. You know, if you're proposing a 16-story block of apartments beside a one-story house, as opposed, or a two-story house, as happened in the inner city recently. There was an amazing photograph, which you may have seen or may not have seen it. I think it was in either the Business Post.
The Business Post.
Well, I mean, it was an astonishing photograph because you saw this poor man in his back garden, and he was going to be absolutely overwhelmed by this ridiculous block of flats at his back door. Mm. It didn't make sense. And I could see no reason why you would build that sort of thing.
Well, you do know why, because it means land extraction value goes up for the developer and they're able to you know, go per unit. And again, maybe he starts off with, say, for example, 63 units, where we've seen recently in Dublin 8, where a co-living unit was refused planning permission, and it's now morphed into an apart hotel. It's again, it's about extracting the maximum profit. So the market works fine. The problem is, it's the market is the dominant force in housing delivery. And again, you mentioned Rory as a former student of yours. There's other former students of yours who advocate that the market, once we get supply right, PJ, will automatically affordability will come on stream. It'll mean that this has happened. But housing has never been logical in that kind of basic economic supply and demand side. It's never worked like that.
Not really. Well, those former students of mine, indeed, they're out there. I know quite a number of them, and I'm deeply unhappy that
they don't like me either. But
and I just didn't teach them properly, or they didn't heed me, I suppose. But really, no. I mean, land is a fundamental issue. Now, take that issue in the inner city, where the massive block of why didn't the state purchase or buy that land instead of those guys who want the 14 block? And why didn't the state buy the land and do a Kenny report on it, by the way? Purchase at existing use value plus compensation of 25%. Never been implemented. It still is relevant. Why didn't the state do that and try to integrate with the existing architecture and to build houses that are livable in, that are pleasant to look at, and so on and so on and so on? I cannot. So they've allowed developers to take over the entire city, the entire Docklands area. So, I mean, but again, it's come back to ideology. You keep mentioning it. You're absolutely correct. Is the state, why doesn't the state play a significant, serious, significant role in relation to land, for example? Land is absolutely fundamental. We cannot get away from it. If a builder purchases land at 6 million an acre, he or she is bound to go up as high as possible and to put as many units on that as possible. So if that land price were down, way, way down, and the planning system did not allow the builder to go up above two or three or four stories, but certainly in some areas, I wouldn't want a five-story beside a one-story house. That would be my own opinion. I worry about apartments, actually, because, and I think the COVID illustrated that if a person is living in an apartment, and unless they have a lot of green space outside or a lot of facilities outside that apartment, then they're boxed in. And I'm a great believer in, if possible, to have a small back garden, especially if couples have kids.
Well, PJ, I put it to you, in the second least densely populated country in the OECD, to have this, the I think it's the first highest rents and the third highest property prices, and all of this race for height doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make sense at all. There was a wonderful letter in the Irish Times there some weeks ago by a woman called Anne, is it Colgan? She's a county councillor in Dundeary, and she wrote really about height and density, and she argued against the height, really. And there's another wonderful man, and he had a piece recently in the paper also, a man called Robin Mandel, M-A-N-D-A-L. He would be very well worth interviewing, actually, Tony, and Martin. And he argues, of course, he's argued very strongly against this fast-track planning racket. I mean, that is the greatest racket of all time.
Yep.
Do they call it SNP?
Yes. Well, strategic.
Strategic planning. So
SZPs and all of these, and they've absolutely run roughshod over. This is why why when people say, again, another economist or celebrity economist who says, you know, the bananas, the build absolutely nowhere, build absolutely nothing. Nowhere ever, whatever this nonsense anagram is. Unfortunately, a lot of the times when people object, we only have to go back to, you know, say, I'm going to name him, Johnny Ronan's phallus in the city centre that he wanted. He wanted a shrine to his to his manhood or whatever it was. It was completely out of keeping with the skyline of Dublin City, and Dublin City doesn't need it because. Well, believe it or not, folks, they tell us we're way behind on apartment use in Ireland relative to our other European capitals. And we're not. We're barely, I think we're about 2% behind Paris, about 3% behind Amsterdam, and about 4 or 5% behind London. We're not outliers. That's nonsense.
No, I agree. I don't want to in any way object to apartment living. And of course, you can argue that apartment living is the norm in throughout Europe. But I know from surveys we did in Trinity many years ago, that we interviewed a very considerable number of apartment dwellers in the 1980s. And we asked them various questions about the adequacy of the apartment and so on. And the criticisms were things like lack of storage, no place to put my bike, you know, very few facilities in the surrounding area. This is in the middle of the city now. But this fundamental argument was, or the fundamental statement was, we will want to move out of here to a little house with a little back garden as soon as possible, whether it's a two-bed terrace with a little back garden or not. That's the sort of thing that young people want in the longer term. So the apartment building is a short-term issue for a lot of people. For older people, maybe when they retire or whatever, an apartment may be an ideal. But I think we have at least have to ask questions about the whole idea of an apartment. Who is it suitable for? We certainly have to ask about height. You can't have dense development without height, actually. Very interesting article in the Business Post recently by Aidan Regan from UCD, where he gave examples of high density without height.
Yep.
I think he talked about 4 to 5 stories high, which is fairly civilized. But 8, 10, 12 stories high, swaying in the wind. If the lift go, did we learn nothing from Ballymun? Did we learn nothing?
Well, in defense of Ballymun, some of the towers that came down were a lot more spacious than the apartments that replaced them.
They were, actually. Oh, no, there was nothing wrong with them in the sense in that the lifts used to break down. And I think,
anyway,
we're back there again. For some developers, that's what they want. But ideology, again, we keep coming back to ideology. And I suppose I wrote a piece some time ago arguing that Keynes, there was a guy called John Maynard Keynes who wrote a book in the 1930s. And he wanted to change the ideology from balancing the, there was a recession, as you know, mm-hmm. late 1929, 30, and so on. And Keynes, the boys, the conservative boys in governments all over the world were saying, well, look, we've got to balance our books. We've got to cut public expenditure. We've got to do this, that, and the other. And Keynes said, no, hold on a second. What we really need to do is we really need to put money into people's pockets. We need to spend money in order to raise the economy again. So that was almost revolutionary at the time. So at a time of difficulty, the COVID was one illustration, really, where finally our Irish government said, God, we've got to spend money. And they didn't worry about it. They begged, borrowed and stole to get that money.
At an interest rate, by the way, that's been blended to just for listeners' benefit, I'm pretty sure my facts and figures are correct on this. Everything we borrowed for the COVID pandemic, the spending on health and protecting our citizens and the PUP and all of these things, was at an interest rate of like 0.16% as a blended interest rate.
There you are. It's for nothing. And you don't have to, by the way, you don't have to pay it back immediately. There's now an obsession with how are we going to pay all this money back? Well, you don't. You roll it over and you roll it over. And as long as the investors are getting an interest rate, that's all they want in the longer term. That's all pension funds want is an interest rate.
Yep.
So it's nonsense to think we have to pay it back tomorrow. Oh, God, let's get worried again.
Yeah.
The very important point now is this on ideology again. Really, every citizen, there should be a floor below which they cannot go in relation to income. So basic income is of... Fenton O'Toole wrote an interesting piece this morning, which you may not have seen, about a place, Stockton, in the United States. And in that little town, they gave 125 people $5 per month for 2 years. And of course, there were many people against this. They said, this is an outrageous thing to do. Why would you do that? Because these layabouts are going to never work again. What happened was, in fact, that a large number of them got employment because their health improved, their mental health improved dramatically, and they began to think again, people who are poor and had nothing. So, I mean, money is fundamental for everybody. And so a change of ideology would mean that governments have to look at society and say, how many people are literally living in poverty all the time? Is that acceptable? And it isn't, really.
It's over 500,000 people, by the way, who are in our category of, you know, we, because if you, because you'll get, again, economists telling us that we have, you know, a huge amount of people who live or earning this amount of money, and this is the, but they don't take into account social transfers and the at-risk of poverty rate and what we call the standards and living index, which you know, have you gone without food? Can you buy shoes for your kids? All of these things that they don't take into account in that headline figure that we keep getting quoted. But it's so it's over 500,000 people at least, and it's much more higher in people, as you pointed out earlier, people with disabilities suffer in great numbers and the likes of that. So we trap people in poverty.
And you cannot leave it. So basically, and of course it does raise one interesting issue, which drives economists mad again, or a lot of them. A lot of people, or a lot of governments, including the government, are obsessed with lowering taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Every day of the week I hear we're going to lower the tax. Now, why? I say, why would you lower the tax? Surely to God, people, are we not able to pay the extra 2 or 3% that you might add on to the 40% rate or to the 20% rate? Obviously, you don't want to penalize people on very low incomes. You must not do that. But certainly, people on large incomes, if they're on 70 or 80,000 or 100,000, and many of them on 200,000. There are bankers in this country. Apparently, there's 15 or 16 of them on over a million. There's one banker on 19 million. Do you think 40% tax rate is enough for that gentleman? Probably a gentleman. It could be a woman.
The top 6% of earners during the pandemic saw their wealth categorization of it went up by 37%.
Yes, but you see, taxation. Therefore, if we're going to do this ideal of a basic income for everybody, we do need the money. If we want to have a decent health service, we do need the money. if we're going to have a decent educational system, if we're going to deal with climate change, we need the money. But taxation is a fundamental issue. You can't lower taxes and have those things as well. It's mad. So we've got to accept that those who are well off should pay more tax. Don't worry, lads. They're not going to leave the country.
No.
They're not going to go on their droves. And, of course, they have special arrangements for executives from abroad. They're so important.
They already get the SERP, the special assignee. I can't remember what the ORP means, but it means they effectively get a discounted tax rate. And also, it's important to point out Ireland has the fifth highest per capita number of billionaires in the world. And that doesn't include our billionaires who live offshore, folks.
I mean, this is the point. There was a period in the States when they were on, I think, 70% tax rate. And the sky didn't fall in. I can't remember the precise, but it certainly was. You can check me up.
They were up to 90% post-war on the tax rates. Up to 90% on the richest people.
Good man. Can I say, sorry, Donny, you want to quiz me? I'm talking too much, really. You guys have to talk more.
No. Look. The listeners know we absolutely love talking to PJ Drury. We always have, and we always will. But I just think it's really important that when you talk about these things, that we have to put them in context. What was really important, you pointed out earlier, the right to housing is a progressively achieved right. It doesn't mean that houses have to fall out of the sky and everybody's given a three-bedroom semi-detached. That's nonsense. So let's bust these myths, right? The other one of taxation, Ireland is still pushing back against the idea of a global corporation tax rate of 15%.
Yep.
That shows us as an outlier. Like I saw in the Irish Times, PJ, who you've just referenced, saying, oh, Irish government worried that moniker of tax haven now starting to stick. I'm sorry, but we've been known about it for years. Like, it hasn't started to stick. We are. It was said on the floor of the US Senate many years ago. You know, that's what we do.
Oh, yes, very unwise to have pushed against virtually every country in the world, apart from a small number. And we said, oh, no, we won't agree to that. It's quite outrageous. And reputationally, it's bloody stupid. Very, very stupid. They should accept that 12.5% is ridiculous. We've gotten away with it for a great many, many, far too many years.
And it's only the headline figure, PJ. It's only the headline figure. I mean, it's not 12.5%, not anywhere close.
Yes, Jimmy Stewart has done some work on that. And Jimmy has shown that a lot of multinationals pay 2 or 3%. Yes.
Again, it's important to point out to listeners, that's not illegal, because if you play by our tax laws, these are the advantages that we will give you. Ireland was the only tax haven that was awarded a green status for tax transparency. So, you know, it's not just that we're a tax haven, we're just bloody well good at it, you know.
The tragedy, really, Tony and Martin, is that the ordinary person in the street. And you, the three of us are ordinary people, really. But me and you,
PJ, not so much your man.
No, Martin isn't. But we're reasonably intelligent. And most people are intelligent. And they really would come up with the sort of things that you and I are talking about. They'd say, well, look, we would pay more tax if we got decent services. We do want housing, everyone to have a house, a reasonable house. We do want a reasonable society. We want a decent health system, and we're prepared to pay for it. So, I mean, we're not talking crazy stuff. We're talking common sense. And I believe, certainly from people I talk to in the street, apart from a very, very few, they will say these sorts of things. And particularly in relation to housing. Can I just say a word, ideology again, that we're concentrating an awful lot in the Dublin area. There's far much too much concentration on Dublin. And we have failed for many, many years to develop what I would call a comprehensive regional policy, where we would spread development throughout the country. If you were to do that again, you would reduce the pressure on Dublin and again reduce house prices and rents. But you have to provide employment in the other parts of the country. So in Cork, Galway, Limerick, Sligo, Mathlone, and so on. So we really need to come back to the idea of a comprehensive regional policy. There are all sorts of fancy titles like Ireland 2040 and lots of documentation and lots of policies, but no implementation. Our problem in this country is implementing what we promise. And, well, a lot of promises by in the Housing for All is a lot of promises. Now, one thing I hope they will deliver, and I'm sorry, I don't want to go back if you don't want me to, Tony and Martin, but really they did promise 9.5. This is a solemn promise, I think, made in blood, I think. And they're saying 9,500 social housing units will be built per annum over the next 5 years. Now, will they actually do that every year? And will they not kind of play hanky-panky with those figures? Will they actually organize that to build them themselves, or will they purchase what they call turnkey projects
exactly
from the private sector? And local authorities and housing associations between them could be major players in this. And I'm involved in the housing association in relation to disability. You mentioned disability earlier. And I think that is an important area for people with intellectual disabilities or physical disabilities or people who are deaf, et cetera, et cetera. Disability is a huge issue. You're talking about 700, maybe 800,000 people who have a disability in this country. And housing is a fundamental issue for all of them. So that's another area that really needs attention. But again, the state, now, by the way, the state can be corrupt. Corruption can occur. There's no use fooling ourselves. And so that has to be watched. Regulation is absolutely fundamental on all of us. If we are lax in relation to regulation, then difficult things occur.
And we have built in a lot of problems over the years, PJ. We've built in unaccountability. We've built in ideology. We've built in a pecking order, which is very hard to shift that paradigm. It's very difficult to shift that paradigm. Is there anything you see, and this last question for me, anything you see that gives you great hope for the future?
Well, the hope really is that we have a very resilient people in this country. We have an awful lot of brain power. I mean, I've come across such remarkable people over the years who have virtually no education at all, particularly when I was involved in the Trinity Access Program in Trinity. And I found that people who had no leaving cert, no nothing, but they had huge amounts of brains. And we brought, in small numbers, we brought them in. And my God, these people excel. So I am totally confident about our people, that they are fantastic people with resilience. But I'm hopeful in a way that there is an emerging view from out there. It was obvious in the last by-election that people do want a decent society. And they reflected it in the vote. Now, I'm not saying that the lady who was elected was an ideal from everybody's point of view at all. But what it did indicate was that the people did not want one of the major parties to get the vote. So, I mean, that's an indication. And I'm not saying that Sinn Féin or any other party would be ideal. But I think there is a change of heart on the part of the people. And that's what's desperately needed, because then they will say to the politicians, you must do the following. And there really is a need. I mean, I see people talking about movements, and Rory has been big on movements. I suppose that does impact on politicians. There's no doubt about it. I'm involved in a national parents association with in relation to disability. And it's interesting how politicians sit up when they have a large number of parents asking for things. They at least sit up. Now, do they do any question? But it is interesting that if we got a broad swell of public opinion saying that sort of things, of course, we believe are right, we would, wouldn't we? Then that would bring about the change that you're looking for, Martin, the ideological change. And it's essential.
Yeah. And PJ, I think that's a great place to leave this. As always, we're delighted to chat to you. And we love coming back to you to get your opinion on stuff. You pretty much nail it down for us, PJ. So thank you again for taking the time to have this chat with us this morning.
Thank you both so much. It's always a pleasure. And
I'm going to tell you the truth. When we told them, some of our supporters on the Patreon, that you were coming on, we had people contacting us from Scotland. We had people contacting us from the US, former students of yours, who were all saying, wow. And we even had comments of, we're going to listen to this by listening to whatever music they were listening to when they were in college, back when you taught them. So it's always fabulous to catch up with you. And we really appreciate you giving us the time. One of the economists who I'm not at war with, Professor Emeritus PJ Drury, thank you for talking to us again. And folks, we'll be back tomorrow with the Sunday show. We will talk to you all very, very soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on